Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
All right. Okay, we've kind of talked about some theological resources. Mormonism, when it comes to natural disasters and things, also has a lot of practical advice that it gives to people in terms of food storage and emergency prep and things like that. And so, Joanna, you'd mentioned to me just in preparation in the week that we have run up to this discussion that you'd been having some interesting blog discussions or at least following some discussions with people as they brought that in. Do you want to kind of take us into that for a minute?
Sure, and you know, it's theological because, you know, practical theology, you know,
good.
The practical is always a theological question. But, you know, I was listening to an especially heartrending news report about food shortages in Japan and in hospitals in Japan where the doctors were subsisting on a scoop of rice so that they could feed all the patients they needed to, and it just really pulled at my heartstrings. And I posted just simply on my Facebook, you know, friends, you know, do you have a year's supply? Are you prepared? Really, you know, it really opened up on my thread a very interesting discussion about emergency preparedness, about LDS teachings, about emergency preparedness, about and about the intentionality and the outcomes of those teachings. And in particular, you know, some interesting points that came up were, you know, the traditional teaching that we maintain in our homes as LDS people, a year's supply of food, in addition to a 72-hour kit, supplies of water that would take us for a couple weeks. You know, that was a practice developed when economic hardship and food shortages were much closer, much more proximate to the experience of many Latter-day Saints. That's not something we so regularly encounter here. The idea that you could be without employment or that a crop failure or something would cause you to rely on your stores for a year. And we've seen that in the teaching of the church, you know, the shift to the advice to keep a 3-month supply a few years ago as a way of making the idea of food storage so much more accessible. So there's some discussion on that. But there was also a discussion that I thought was even more interesting about, you know, what are we obliged to do as LDS people who have a tradition of emergency preparedness when we face catastrophic situations? And very clearly, two camps opened up on the thread. And one was the people who were prepared to hoard and to fend off others and to make their year's supply last their family a whole year. And then there were others of us who said, well, I have a year's supply, but it's going to last me 9 days because I'm not going to, you know, the neighbors are going to be over. And that's how I understand my obligation as an LDS person who is prepared to a community. And so I wanted to explore just the way, the ethical and the practical aspects of coming from a tradition that has emphasized emergency preparedness and catastrophe preparedness, and to explore the ways that those factor in. Is it true that millennial mindsets are waning in LDS culture? How does that impact our notions of preparedness and our day-to-day choices as LDS people?
Awesome. Who wants to go? Great training.
I have very little on that.
I would say, I'm surprised that there would be anybody in the LDS tradition who thought that their supply of food was for them alone. I mean, I've always heard the opposite emphasized whenever emergency preparedness has been taught. I would say, in my church life, I've only encountered one sort of radical millennialist who ended up writing a book claiming that he knew exactly when the Savior was coming, and he was my home teacher at one point.
And, hey, hey.
And, and, uh, and was given specific instruction from his bishop not to go around preaching his beliefs about when he thought the Savior was coming and when natural disasters were coming, but he did so anyway. But I don't think, I think maybe the fact that the year 2000 came and went without a whole lot. I mean, 2001 was a big year, obviously, but I think my sense is, I was born in 1964 and you know, certainly felt like it was very much within the realm of possibility that I would see the end of the world before I died. I'm much more skeptical about that these days, and in fact, sort of actively fighting those feelings because of the way it sometimes causes one to acquiesce to a kind of inevitability about things. Right. But that's different from emergency preparedness, which I think is very wise. I do think, I might be wrong about this, but my understanding is the church has shifted to a 3-month supply.
Right, that's right.
To emphasize. And one thing that I've come across in some of my readings in environmental thought is the idea that something like the buy local movement and trying to develop a greater sense of a local economy is also a very vital strategy for a kind of emergency response to disaster, right? I mean,
that's lovely.
It doesn't take much for our trucking industry to come to a halt for us
exactly.
to be in very desperate
right.
straits to get food. But if there is, sort of the 100-mile radius or 50-mile radius ethic that some people are using to buy their food, and there's a greater sense of local self-reliance, I'd like to see that emphasized a little bit more.
Yeah, and you know, that was a big part of the early experience of Utah, regional self-sufficient economies.
Right.
Yeah,
it's very
evident in the Word of Wisdom, in my judgment. I mean, if you're eating fruit in season and you're eating a healthy diet lower on the food chain, as the Word of Wisdom describes it, you're much less dependent on those global processes. The average American meal apparently travels 1,300 miles to get to your plate, which is not only very wasteful and damaging to the environment, but also makes you very vulnerable.
You know, I think what you said, George, is really interesting and provocative. I love the idea of leveraging, you know, the traditional Mormon sensibility of emergency preparedness and pioneer can do into, you know, a sense of environmental responsibility, because I think right now, oftentimes in mainstream Mormonism, even with the law of consecration that teaches us be prepared, whatever you have will belong to everyone, to imagine environmental disasters as a scene of social catastrophe as well. You know, the profound fraying of the social contract, especially if you live in the mission field, as it were, outside of predominantly LDS communities, you know, the sensibility can be, well, you know, there's going to be looting, you know, disaster is going to be accompanied by a need to protect your family in places where LDS people are the minority. But, you know, shifting away from that notion of what catastrophe entails to a sense that being prepared for an emergency means being responsible and aware of your consumption patterns and how those might be impacted by any number of a range of breakdowns, environmental, political, social, would be a great direction to spur, you know, discussion in Mormon communities.
Yeah, it seems kind of foolish to sort of stack your house full of foodstuffs and yet your lifestyle is incredibly wasteful. You know, it sort of reminds me of the prayer for rain that is not accompanied by careful conservation of water. You know?
Exactly.
This is very good.
What kind of theological sense does that make?
We
could all be lucky and be in natural disasters. That came out totally wrong. I don't mean to at all diminish the suffering in Japan, but one thing I admire so much about what's happening there is how little looting there is. As you were saying that, I thought, well, you know, if a natural disaster, if everyone could be like the Japanese in response, we wouldn't have to worry about those kinds of problems.
Right. And I should say that, you know, someone who's kind of studied Katrina a bit from the social, political, cultural aspects, you know, reports of looting in the U.S. are always specifically exploited, you know, by the media.
Yeah, yeah.
And they fall into some centuries old notions of property and whose property is it under what kind of threat from whom. But I just wanted to add, in terms of, you know, locavore movements, there are whole branches of contemporary Jewish tradition that have focused on redefining kosher laws in terms of vegetarian eating, ethical eating, locavore eating, just totally redefined what kind of a commitment God expects out of people who profess to be in a covenant relationship with him. I just love to see, you know, I think we have something very special in Mormon tradition in terms of a very practical outlook on catastrophe, a tremendous sense of comfort and preparedness that we face, you know, all is safely gathered in. If you're prepared, you need not fear. It's something that a lot of my non-Mormon friends on my Facebook thread, even as their jaws were dropping, as some of my more survivalistic friends talked about hoarding cigarettes to barter with.
Wow, yeah, I've heard that. Toilet paper, cigarettes, and chocolate.
Are they going to hoard pornography for the same reason?
You know what? That came up. I didn't want to say it because I was trying to be polite, but someone said, yes, that they'd been advised to hoard non-digital pornography, and I thought, that's just over the top for me. But I had several non-LDS friends contact me and say, what exactly is in your 72-hour kit? Because I really do think I need one. I mean, there's so much we have to share as LDS people in terms of the, you know, the sense of being able to do for the people you love when catastrophe strikes.
Well, and the thing that's fascinating to me is that, and this is maybe slightly different shift, Dan, I don't know if you want to go in this direction, but the humanitarian efforts on the part of the church, you know, when you look at where aid is needed and where the most desperate circumstances are, they are, when we think about natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes, you know, I mean, I know there was debate about whether or not we could know for sure if Katrina was more intense because of climate change and that sort of thing. But just the very ambiguity of that question is interesting to me. We don't know sometimes. I mean, earthquakes, maybe we don't have a human causal element playing into the inception of the problem, but certainly there's cultural, political ramifications as soon as natural disasters happen. But some of those, like if you look at what happened in Haiti with the floods, I mean, the fact that there are mudslides in the Dominican Republic and Haiti and elsewhere in the Caribbean has to do with the human history of that region and the history of slavery and deforestation.
That's right.
Because
crops,
of subsistence economies. So you can't easily separate natural from human disasters.
That's right.
When I think about the way the church goes about its humanitarian efforts, it's obvious that we are pumping aid into the areas of the world that are being affected by environmental problems. And oftentimes, those, not all, but oftentimes those problems are also linked to climate change issues. And it seems to me that in addition to the sort of immediate first aid that's needed in emergency situations, there's a longer term kind of lifestyle shift that we need to consider in order to be truly ethical. And as Joanna mentioned earlier, I think the church's move to greening its architecture is a very positive step in that direction. But I think as church members, there's a lot more we could do.
We can do more. Go ahead.
No, there's a huge question. I just kind of want to turn back to Dwayne and because George's comments remind me, you know, we haven't talked a ton about in this discussion about the role of human agency and what science teaches us about climate change and human agency and how that's received in LDS communities. I know your main thrust has been evolution, but have you talked climate change and done the same kind of work around climate change, Dwayne?
Well, yes, we have, but Utah's a hotbed of anti-science change type people at the moment. I would say that the majority of people in Utah buy into the Tea Party idea that this is all just a big conspiracy on the part of scientists, as though you could ever get scientists to conspire on anything.
Right.
But they are very, very deprecating about the whole idea of climate change. They will sometimes admit, you know, when you really push them to it, they'll admit it occurs, but they will absolutely refuse to acknowledge any human, any anthropogenic component to climate change at all. So they don't want to do anything about it because, you know, it's just what's going to happen and we can't do anything and we didn't contribute to it, we can't do anything about it, so forget it. That's the overwhelming feeling I see here in Utah.
Yep.
Which plays into that fatalism, right?
It really does.
You know, that sense, well, it's such a big issue and it's all in God's hands, so I'm gonna be uninterested in informing myself further.
That's the case.
Very good. Go ahead.
No, it was just an anecdote. Not necessary at all.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Next to my notes was George had shared also as we were gearing up for this week that he had a couple of interesting anecdotes that he thought offered neat perspectives on Japan and just sort of these questions. George, did you want to jump in with any of that?
Well, I was in the 89 earthquake in the Bay Area. And I have to say, I mean, if I've ever felt God in nature, I would say there were two times, and one was in the 89 earthquake in San Francisco, and the other was on top of a volcano in Chile, watching hot lava come forth. I mean, there's just something about the tremendous force of the natural world that causes this radical sense of humility, and you just want to get on your knees and beg for forgiveness and pray for mercy. And I think in some ways that's kind of a fruitful response. I don't mean to say that that's because one is obligated to believe that God is punishing somebody through that, but I don't see why that would be an undesirable outcome of these kinds of events. But the anecdote I shared was that if you remember the circumstances of the earthquake, it happened at 5:05 p.m., if I'm remembering correctly, or maybe it was 5:15. For some reason, those two numbers are confused in my mind. But it was just as the first game of the World Series was taking place at Candlestick Park between the San Francisco Giants and the Oakland A's. I mean, it was a big deal because it was a Bay Area series. And I was a huge Oakland A's fan, so I was very excited to get home from graduate class over at Berkeley back to the Palo Alto area where I was living, my wife and I were living, and I was walking to my car when the earthquake hit, and you know, you get tremors in the Bay Area frequently as you do down in Southern California, and I almost fell over from the tremor just walking on the sidewalk in Berkeley, which had never happened, anything like that had happened before, but the mind just doesn't register that it's that serious. I got in my car and all my radio channels were off, and the only thing I could think was that something was wrong with my car radio. Then I see a black cloud over Berkeley, and all I could think was there was just a random fire somewhere. You know, I mean, nothing was registering. I get on the highway just south of the Nimitz Freeway, and there are no cars on the highway, and it's 5:15, 5:30 in the afternoon, which is normally ridiculous traffic, and the only thing I could think was, oh, I'm going to get home in time for the game.
You are not from here.
My radio started working. I started hearing what was going on. Well, anyway, sorry. What happened was there was a man who was at the game who owned a Ferrari, and he went, you know, the game was canceled. Everyone left the stadium, and he comes out to find that his car's been stolen. He calls the police and says, hey, my Ferrari's been stolen. I mean, this is in the newspaper, so I'm not making this up. It has to be true. And the police tell him, well, okay, we'll make note of this. But obviously, we've got other problems on our hands right now. And several months later, he gets a call, and they say, the good news is we found your car. The bad news is the criminal who stole it was killed in the car when the Nimitz Freeway collapsed during the earthquake, which was on the other side of the bay. This guy had stolen the car. There were 69 people who were killed when the highway collapsed. It was just a sandwich, right? So it's a perfect tale of, like, you know, divine retribution for a crime. But there was a Relief Society president carrying an elderly man to the hospital who was also killed in that collapse. So, you know, when we try to theologize about macro events like that, I think we have to recognize we're talking about a complexity that the human mind can't possibly wrap itself around. And it's not to say that God can't be in those events. I believe in some way he is, but I'm in no position to judge how.
Very interesting. Very fun. Cool. Dwayne, does that make you want to share your anecdote, or should we move on to something else?
No, I'll let it go.
Okay.
Like a true scientist.
Yeah. Back to the kind of the framing of this podcast as doing a theology of nature rather than natural theology. In other words, we want to say that it's important to have our view of God and whatnot unfold the more we learn about science, rather than marrying ourselves to older models and things like that. And there's been some dangers in the past of doing that. And Duane, in the preface or the introduction or whatever to one of the books that you did, you talked about religion can only do about three things with science. You say, of course, they can attack it, and many religious concepts now lie in the dustbin of history from that approach. Religion can ignore it, and for which case they progressively become incapable of addressing modern and future problems. Or three, they can engage it and incorporate the demonstrated truths found thereby into a more productive view of their overall universe. And that, to me, you know, is resonant with your life and the types of things that you've been doing. And I was reminded of, like, for instance, the story of how at one time the church married itself to the concept of an ether. I should have reminded you about this ahead of time in case you needed to think about it. Can you tell us that story of what you thought was going on there, what was gained, and then what was lost when sort of the disappearance of the concept of ether was going on, and how that can kind of help us frame this larger discussion of now that we know so much more about how the Earth's processes work,
go ahead. I'm not a historian of chemistry or that sort of thing, but I believe I can do some basics. The universal ether, as it was known, was supposedly some sort of almost ethereal nothing, but it was a substance that was supposed to fill the whole universe.
Right, and it was needed. It was needed as a hypothesis, because if light is a wave needs a medium through which to travel through.
Correct.
So I know that was a big part of the reason for postulating it.
Well, people really had that going, and it was John A. Widzo who really tied into it more than anyone else and suggested that this was the medium through which the Holy Ghost operated. Of course, that meant that when we decided there was no such thing as universal ether, then all of a sudden the Holy Ghost had no medium through which to operate. And you know, fortunately, we have finally forgotten that idea and left that in the dustbin of history, too. Elder Widzo just jumped onto it a bit too quickly. But I think we have people doing the same kind of thing on many of our health issues. Joanna mentioned, you know, the strong herbalist tradition and so on in Mormonism. I really wish we could also get people to know the power of double-blind experiments and validation.
Yep.
I have a number of friends here who are medical doctors and who just constantly wring their hands in frustration and watch people die with operable and curable cancer because their family or themselves or their spouse insists on trying herbal treatments. And that's colon cancer, for instance. You know, that is inherently curable if you catch it early. And in many cases, my friends have caught it early, but the family and the people insist on going the herbal route. And so I do wish that we could instigate a little stronger sensitivity to asking for real data sometimes instead of just anecdotes.
Yeah, and again, part of the overall question that I guess I admitted in my framing of why I think it's important to respond to people in church with better thoughts or at least richer views or something, and that is we see so many... we see damage to a church that holds too rigidly to these things. So, for instance, a lot of the skeptical or the people who are moving towards atheistic views or natural, you know, pure natural humanism instead of out of Mormonism come because of these mistakes of trying to marry, particular views, you know, and say this is absolutely it, only to have the science, you know, move things along, and so they again they lose faith in this and stuff like that. So I just wanted to bring that up, that you know we don't want to be in danger of that, and I think George has always done a good job on this podcast of saying we always need to be humble in our interpretations, but I just thought that was an interesting piece to remind us of, that that somehow or other when we marry ourselves too closely even to the most recent and up-to-date science, we can ultimately hurt ourselves if we don't have that humility.
You bet we can. And there needs to be the distance, but there needs to be a healthy engagement.
Engagement, good.
About the three responses a religion can make, my real concern is that Mormonism is drifting into the ignoring science and becoming more and more incapable of addressing scientific issues and modern problems.
Yes, and that's another reason that people will leave too when they see that that's, you know, if I'm not getting some sort of wisdom based upon what's going on today, then it just becomes more and more irrelevant. And I think that's certainly going to be a problem with young people if we continue down that path.
Hey, Dwayne, I got a question for you, because I've always admired what you've done and others have done and in the biological sciences at BYU, and I've always felt like Mormonism doesn't have it has a very positive official stance about science. But you're describing Mormonism. I'm just wondering what Mormonism are you referring to? Are you referring to I think the most obvious target I can think of that you're describing is maybe the political culture of Utah. But I wonder if you would make a distinction between that and Mormonism in general, or whether you do feel like Mormonism in general is moving away from science. Because I don't see that. I see people like Elder Scott in the Quorum of the Twelve, or statements, like Elder Oaks' recent statement that, well, we don't know about the biological origins of homosexuality. We'll leave that to the scientists. I mean, those kinds of statements seem to me to be official statements of respect for what science does, and some open detachment to, you know, as we were just describing it, not necessarily jumping on what the latest theory is or what we want the scientific truth to be. I like that kind of openness, and I feel it officially, but I don't feel it maybe on some other kind of political, cultural level here in Utah. What's your sense?
I guess I am seeing the incredible shift toward anti-science feelings since the mid-1950s that I've already indicated a bit. The willingness to ridicule science in church classes and so on. I hear of that sort of thing quite regularly. You mentioned Elder Scott, and I would be extremely happy if Elder Scott would finally address something with science and religion, but he's been totally quiet on the issue. Elder Oaks, of course, made the statement about, let me back up a bit. There were statements, a long series of statements, that there was no scientific evidence for homosexuality. Elder Faust's comment about, you know, there's no evidence for homosexuality, that would ruin the entire plan of salvation. Elder Holland, at least, were assigned to try to do something in the ensign that would be try to move the church to a healthier position to deal with gay issues. And Elder Oaks finally published that one article wherein he was quite willing to acknowledge that there is indeed a genetic influence here, but we're all still responsible for the way we deal with it. About that time, the church got involved with the Proposition 22 thing in California,
right.
And I think that that put everything on hold and for years until Elder Holland's article finally came out, and it was just totally milquetoast. So we really have nothing that's dealing with the issue particularly. Now, let me drop in one anecdote that may be relevant. When I was a graduate student, I was called to a little committee to try to write manuals for the Aaronic priesthood. And our committee decided to take it for the teachers, and because that seemed to be the most critical bunch. And we actually did something totally unheard of. We went out and interviewed some of the teachers and said, what kind of things would you like to talk about in priesthood meeting? So we developed, as the presiding bishop's office directed us, a proposal for what good manuals ought to be. And we dealt with such issues as sex education, and that's included maturation, not only in males and females. But we're quite aware that LDS parents don't do very well with sex education, and so the young men indicated they wanted something on this. But we tried to deal with drug issues and peer pressure and a whole batch of these sorts of things. And Elder Simpson from the presiding bishop's office came down and gave us about a 25-minute praising sermon on what an incredible job we'd done, and this was exactly what our young men needed, and then said, but you can't use it. You write a manual that a convert of 3 weeks can pick it up and teach the lesson.
Wow.
And we were just dumbfounded. We said, you're gonna dumb the whole church down to that level? Yes. We said, well, are we dealing here with the future leaders of the church? Oh, yes. Well, then why don't we try to do something? Well, what percentage of the wards and stakes the branches do you think have anybody that could teach this without blowing the whole place sky high? And we said, well, we'd be dumb enough to try. His comment was, we think 3%. And we said, okay, we'll do you a deal. We'll make you a deal. We'll write two manuals. Certainly in the stakes, you can tell your bishops, you pick the best person you've got in ward, and you put him in charge of the teacher's quorum, and you teach these deals, because we're going to put a lot of how-to things and help for the teachers along with this, and we'll write a three-week convert one for the branches and the districts. And he said no. And he hit us with an objection that we couldn't answer, and he said that will introduce elitism into the church.
Yeah.
It'll be the milk manual and the meat manual, and we just can't have elitism in the church. I hope someday, said he, that we can do the kind of manuals we've got, because that's what we need, but we can't do it now. And I would argue that we are further away from being able to do that now than we were then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You look at what we're studying for the adult manual now, you know what it is. It was the investigator's manual in 1979.
Right.
And now we're using it for the adults, the high priests, et cetera, et cetera. I would argue that we are further away from being able to deal with issues, both modern political issues and modern scientific issues, than we were back in pre-1950s.
Well, I still don't see, I see silence on a lot of issues, but I don't see active anti-scientific teachings coming from the church. That's all I'm trying to describe. And so I wonder where the anti-science is coming from, because I don't see it in the doctrine and I don't see it in official teachings. Does that make sense? I see a manual that's absent of that science, but I don't necessarily see that anything in the manuals that we're using is incompatible with science.
Well, I think. Sorry, Duane, go ahead.
Go ahead, Joanna.
No, I think what Duane's anecdote just brings out so powerfully, it's so important, is, you know, the project of correlation, you know, nominally in the service of a global church, introduced sort of a self-contained, static, conceptual mapping of theological knowledge that actually has licensed laziness and opportunism and a lack of rigor and a lack of humility, and is actually sort of opposed to the kind of accounts of knowledge seeking we get in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, and the way we understood the enterprise of being a Mormon person as constantly seeking greater light, greater knowledge. And it's an administrative choice, but it's one that's ceded a tremendous amount of ground and that it's been abused.
It is indeed. And George, I would suggest two or three things. One, we could start with the current student's manual on the Old Testament. I was invited up to speak to the faculty of the LDS Institute adjacent to the University of Utah a few years ago. And after we discussed a number of things, I said, I want to ask you guys a question. Why do you keep using that Old Testament manual? And they just laughed at me. They said, we don't use that old manual. And I said, well, what do you use? And I said, well, we use our own stuff, because, you know, that one just turned kids off and makes them think the church is definitely anti-science, which it is. And I said, well, why don't you use the manual? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, one was written here about 3 years ago. We got permission to do that, and so a committee was put together to make a new manual. And we got it written, and it got passed up the line, and we had one administrator up the line, they had mentioned who it was, who said, oh, I think it'll cost us too much to publish a new manual, so we'll just stick with the old one. So we're still driving kids away from the church, that's CES. We still have a number of seminary teachers who love blasting science. I hear about them all the time. We're making, I think, headway on that. I think you're aware that the dean of religion at BYU now is a scientist,
a
PhD in archaeobotany, and a good, solid fellow. And they do have religion professors who have bachelor's degrees in the sciences and engineering and so on. But I think we're moving on that. But we still have at least one person there who is actively blasting science just about every chance he gets. And that's in the religion department at BYU, Religion College. So, no, they're still out there, George.
I don't have any experience with the church curriculum, but in the 13 years I've been at BYU, and I don't teach in science actively, but I have actually co-taught a few classes with biologists at BYU, and sure. I've been blown away by the scientific curiosity of the students. And have seen over 13 years just an enormous wave of interest among students in the environment and interest in science and interest in theological questions relating to science. And as slow as the progress has been over those 13 years, I've never felt like it's gotten worse. I've always felt like there's greater and greater awareness of environmental issues and environmental problems. I mean, I'm speaking maybe exclusively on this particular issue, but I feel cautiously optimistic rather than feeling that it's sort of shutting down. And part of that I attribute to, I would say to two things. One is just the dynamism and interest of the students who organize themselves into clubs, who push their professors to want to get courses dealing with certain subjects in the environment that are of concern to them. And I think the faculty are engaging now in more cross-disciplinary conversations about the environment than there has been historically at BYU. So in those senses, I see that as a positive trend. And I'm just a half glass half full versus half empty kind of guy. I mean, I want to see reasons why things can be built on rather than getting too cynical about what's not happening, because I still think the doctrines are still there, the opportunities for the conversations are still there. I think that's, Dan, right? What this is part of the
project
is about, and I think there are lots of other kinds of conversations and projects that we might be engaged in and that are going on that hopefully open up those kinds of trends. I just want to be striking that optimistic tone, in part because, as Dan is saying, you know, the people who feel the most discouraged in the church about things they don't see happening are the ones we need to stay in.
Well, I think it's critical, George, to recognize the tremendous contribution that you and Steve have made. And other folks, you've published a book also with Terry Ball, haven't you?
Yeah.
And I think that's very, very critical, and I think that is making progress. At the same time, I'm one who has to kind of deal with some of the, some of the stuff down in the gutter, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of the pathologist that has to watch what's going on.
Yeah, you're the designated fixer, the cleaner.
So, that definitely colors, my point of view. You know, we're still jousting with some of those things. Yeah,
Dwayne, well, I remember the presentation you gave to my honors colloquium when I was a freshman or sophomore at BYU, and you saved me, so keep it up. It pays off.
Oh, well, thank you, Joanna. I'm glad to hear that.
Very cool. And George, I really appreciate you going back there. I was about to make a joke at the end of Dwayne's, anecdote there about how depressed I am, and I can't even continue the podcast, just because that was sad. So I appreciate the glass half full perspective getting back in there, and I really appreciate that thing, the angles. Go ahead.
Well, I've drawn a lot of inspiration from reading and interacting with a lot of people in the environmental movement, both in academia and in political circles. And you don't get involved in something like that without some degree of hope and faith and trust that things a difference can be made and that it must be made and that there's enough goodwill out there to make things like that happen. And we're not radically unique in the obstacles that we're facing when it comes to attitudes about the environment and about stewardship and about human suffering in the world. I mean, this is a global, at least certainly speaking nationally. I mean, it's a national problem, if not a global problem, of indifference and ignorance and you know, a huge gap between what we know scientifically and how we act politically or how we think religiously. These are not Mormon problems only, and I think there are a lot of people to work with and collaborate with beyond the Mormon culture that we can look to, because if we're going to make a difference, we've got to make a difference not just within Mormonism but everywhere.
No, it very definitely is not just a Mormon situation, and we are in far better position than most of the evangelicals, for instance.
Yep.
When we get to issues of science, we can quote First Presidency.
And yeah. That's kind of what I was getting at, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a matter of religion versus the scientists anymore. It's a matter of the anti-scientists versus the First Presidency. And the evangelicals just don't have that. You know, they'll stay with the old Bible-thumping tradition, and they've locked themselves into where they have no flexibility. So
yeah,
we do advantage over them. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. And we mentioned the evangelical. I listen a lot to Krista Tippett and her podcast and whatnot. And she has had some evangelicals who have gotten into a green sort of movement. But about the most robust area that they're able to use is just the concept of stewardship, as
yes.
You know, as being part of the biblical tradition. And they don't have these wider, richer resources that we do within Mormonism. But I certainly admire that they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, the Evangelical Environmental Network is a fantastic group.
And I would certainly like to see the Correlation Committee put something more on stewardship in our own manuals. It's just not there.
Yeah. I was about to say, you know, I came away from this with the understanding that correlation is bad for the environment, but correlation could be used to promote stewardship. I mean,
well,
I think,
you know, it's also the great irony of religious, you know, the studies that I've read, so sociological studies on religion and the environment, is that the jury is still out as to whether or not teaching the right doctrines makes any difference in people's attitudes. You know, tragically, our attitudes about the environment, I mean, religion seems like the primary source, right, for our attitudes about nature, because that's where we hear those stories of creation, the origins of humankind, and what our moral obligations are. So one would think that those would be the sites at which you could shape the moral imagination of people more powerfully than in any other way. The same arguments made in literature generally, as Joanna knows, right, where if you can, stories make a difference, and stories shape the moral imagination, the kinds of stories we tell could shift people's attitudes. But in the end, you know, for better or for worse, we're free agents, and we interpret badly, and we wrest the scriptures, we selectively read, we don't read with repentance in mind enough to do the kind of self-questioning that I think religion requires of us. I mean, religion, and it's one of its root meanings, is to reread, you know, so we always have to go back and say, wait a minute, did I miss something? And it seems like the story of the creation in the Mormon tradition, I'm on a soapbox here, but, you know, among all of the great things that Joseph Smith restored, it seems patently obvious that the story of the creation was given special emphasis, right? There are three accounts that he restores, and one of them sits smack in the middle of the temple ceremony, and the other two in the restored scriptures in the Pearl of Great Price. And that seems to be something we are asked to revisit again and again, but I think, you know, our reading skills have been diminished for a variety of reasons, not just because of correlation, but you know, the crassness of our culture and so on and so forth. We don't know how to read in this culture anymore. Anyway, I'm just venting now.
Well, we are all educators, and education is an optimistic and if you don't think you can make a difference, you shouldn't be in it. And so I think we all have to have an optimistic outlook, yes.
And I have a dream that someday at General Conference, we will hear something about creation care or stewardship that matches the intensity and commitment with which the church is willing to speak out on, you know, pornography or homosexuality or any of it, any of it.
Yeah. You know, I have heard, I did talk to Jared Doxey of the Church Architecture Department when he gave us a tour of that Green Chapel in Farmington with the solar panels and the LEED certification that's going on and the attempt that they're now making to make all Future Chapels LEED certified. We asked him, you know, that's great. We were all ecstatic when we saw what was happening, but we said, is there going to be an accompanying revamping of the teaching of the church when it comes to self-reliance, provident living, and emergency preparedness that includes more instruction on stewardship? And he said they're working on it. So,
Nate. Nate.
I mean, he recognized, and what's really cool about that chapel is that in the ward library there's a computer screen that can produce readouts of how many pounds of carbon that building is saving, how many gallons of gas that building is saving, how many, you know, it can translate the savings into how many hours of your blow dryer you're saving. It's pretty cool, and they put it in the library because they want that to be there for the youth.
Very cool.
You say that's in Bountiful or where?
What's that?
That chapel is in Bountiful or where?
Farmington.
They're
building four prototypes that are LEED certified, and they're applying to LEED for a portfolio certification, which would basically mean they could then roll out all future chapels according to that prototype, and all of them receive LEED certification.
Good.
Neat.
That
all right.
Optimism.
Cool. Hey, you guys, this has been amazing, and I still want to go one more area. Are you guys comfortable with that? Okay, let's try it. We'll just break this up into chunks.
As long as it's not my adolescent childhood or anything.
Well, I'll darn cross this part off then. Anyway, well, I wanted to go back to theology and richer framings, richer views of God and nature and just sort of where you guys base your environmental spirituality and whatnot. And the first question that might be a good lead into it is one that we've kind of touched around a little bit before, and that is the where is God question. Where is God in these evils? George, you've been the most, I'm not sure that I wasn't allowing for it as well, but I was pushing sort of the idea that perhaps I was almost sounding like a deist or something there, where God set up this world, created it with plate tectonics and all the different forces and regulatory mechanisms and whatnot, and God doesn't do any button pushing to actually, you know, cause it to happen. So I was probably going too extreme that, and I was glad for you to bring it back to that. But I do think that there's a rich area that we could all probably make a statement on, or something that sort of, in a theistic worldview, if we were to say that God isn't in this particular earthquake or that particular time or place, there is something we could say probably for sure that God is always there for, and that is being with His people, or, you know, in the suffering itself, that even if God doesn't create the evil and the suffering, and I'm talking here with cancer, with Down syndrome, you know, cystic fibrosis, any of these genetic things that might be there, God has the ability to still redeem that suffering, you know, to somehow make that into something great. So are any of you interested in going that direction a little bit?
Well, I can't go there very far. I've dealt quite a bit with genetic defects, and it's a difficult issue to work with. You know, there are the rationales about this person chose that body in the pre-existence, and this body is to teach the family patience and love and compassion. Those can help some people. They don't help other people at all, and that seems to be the usual story about, you know, life is kind of what you do with it, and you know, you make your own, you deal with the hand you're given and do the best you can do. I've seen some pretty tragic experiences with people who tried to prevent or alter the risks, the genetic risks for future children born in the family by extensive family prayer and fasting and so on, and still lost on the bet. It's hard for them to keep some sort of religious faith when they've lost on the big gamble. And so I have no effective therapy to work with on that, other than, you pray to God, you seek all the strength you can get, because you're going to need it in some of these cases. And And many people will report finding tremendous comfort and faith and strength in so doing that. But it's an individual search.
You know, when I wrote Home Waters as a, essentially it started out as a nature journal, and I found myself, when I thought about nature, when I was out in nature trying to think about it in a theological way and try to gain greater sense of environmental awareness, I couldn't escape thinking about my own life, my sufferings, the sufferings of other people, the sufferings of early Utah history. In the end, I think in nature, I feel the closest to a suffering God. I feel that the atonement is probably the only answer to some of these questions, that Christ is a compassionate God who, as the word implies, suffers with us.
Good.
And I think suffering with somebody doesn't always involve answering theological questions or problems or giving reasons. I think it's a feeling after somebody, right? And I think we can all think of anecdotes where, you know, silent compassion or acts of service have done more to comfort people than words that people sometimes quickly or thoughtlessly offer at funerals, you know, to try to tell somebody else why something happened to them.
Exactly.
I think the atonement is really, the greatest source of hope when it comes to what it means to suffer in the physical condition. I know Mormonism is an extremely optimistic theology, but I think it's clear that not only does the verse say that Adam fell that men might be and men are that they might have joy, but we also understand from other verses that we are here to suffer, and that it wasn't just joy that we were given, but suffering, joy not being possible without suffering, right? So there's an important obligation on the part of a believer to have the kind of faith to be able to live through suffering and find joy even in suffering, or, you know, from suffering. I think that's really, all of that happens, I think, oftentimes without any intellectual content, right, without any answers to specific questions. But I think that's sort of the trust of the Spirit and the experience of faith.
Very good, very good. Some other just little pieces about that we could certainly bring in, and whether it's intellectually heard or makes a difference, or if it's just felt. I mean, I do think Mormonism has that terrific view of God being in this together with us, that this is a cooperative effort. This salvation is group as well as individual, and God's in the midst of it all. I think you mentioned the compassion of God. We have the wonderful passage from the Book of Moses about God weeping with creation, and that God suffers too, and that we've got all those different kinds of things. And so this idea that whether or not God's involved in the actual causing of a particular act of suffering, whether it's natural disasters or disease or whatever, I think that idea of atonement and God with us and being at one with us in our suffering is very powerful. So I appreciated that. Joanna, did you have something?
Yeah. Well, just quickly, and I think my computer's my battery's gonna die, so I'll have to drop off the conversation, I'm afraid. But you know, God has always spoken to Mormon people out of doors, and you know, the first vision happened in a grove of trees, and I think about our ancestors who crossed the plains, and of the way I was taught as a child growing up and a young woman growing up in LDS culture to reverence the outdoors through our very, you know, my stake had a very robust camp crafter program. I know a lot of girls these days don't, but, you know, I always understood a reverence for a creation that was animated by spirit, all of it animated by spirit, as being a very robust and important part of our theology and our tradition. And so, you know, I think that as in any progressive cause, we can't be cowed by people who have taken administrative decisions on the part of church's license for laziness, rigor, and lack of humility. And we each have to take responsibility for our own role as stewards not only of creation, but of a Mormon tradition that often gets short shrift for its actual richness.
You know, one concept just real quick is that I think this Mormon account of Christ's suffering includes the suffering, as a friend of mine pointed out to me recently, of animals and of the creation itself. There's a tremendous amount of suffering in the creation just through the process of dying, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and all life requires life. I mean, the life is something else. It's all
it's
that
violent,
whole thing.
It's a violent, bloody reality.
Yeah, there's a great phrase from Gary Snyder, the poet, who talks about turning enmity with nature into an intimacy with nature, and really a recognition of our embeddedness in this cycle of life and death, and that our life requires the death of others. And he cites a Buddhist prayer over a meal that I really like, which is something along the lines of, "We're thankful for this meal, the work of many hands, and the sharing of other forms of life." You know, I'm not ready to try that at war dinner, but I do think that recognition always that our food comes from the life of something else that would have preferred to live, whether it's animal or vegetable. There's another one of his poems that talks about recognizing what's on our plate was once the swish of a lamb's tail, or something along those lines. And so that intimacy with what we're doing and our embeddedness in us, I think, is a rich framing
I think that's what DNC 59 describes, so maybe you should use it at your ward prayer.
Very cool. I'll have to reread. So good. Well, Joanna, we don't want to lose you, but I do think we could probably close about now. If you do fall off, we apologize for that. But if you guys would take one final shot at something here, and that would be kind of a closing remarks that says, if you were to do an argument from design, so in other words, if you were to go back to natural theology rather than a theology of nature, and you take the natural world as we understand it, and we see the things about it that we see, what would you say that nature says about God? So if you were to go from the bottom up and say, what would be some attributes of this God that strike you as, and that might be a nice closing framing. So Joanna, why don't you go first, if you don't mind, just in case we lose you.
Aye, aye, aye.
Okay, and I guess I should have planned, given you a heads up on this. So don't if you don't want to. But you know, who's the God that you believe in, especially that you gain from pondering these types of questions?
Well, let me just, a quick anecdote. My 5-year-old prays, every prayer she says, she prays for the trees and bushes. And tonight she said she was embarrassed to say that prayer at church. She didn't want to pray in front of other Mormon people for trees and bushes. And I tried to prod her why a little bit. But, you know, for me, I have a very immanent sense of God and of all parts of the creation as being a manifestation of God's presence. And and that's the God I know.
And what's that God like, given what you experience of nature?
Extremely complex. Luminous.
I think she's gone, Dan.
Darn it, I haven't seen her drop off, at least as far as what I'm seeing on my Skype hookup, but looks like there she just barely went. For those listeners who, if in case we keep this part in, Joanna talks through us in her car because in her home that's about the only quiet place that she could do, so she was running on battery power there. But I think she got us started on that. Dwayne or George, just so we don't need to pick this up on a different day, would you guys mind closing with sort of a vision or a robust God that you believe in based upon, your deep ponderings on these things?
Well, I would pick it as God is a God of law. And, the one thing that even scientists who do not happen to have a religious faith at all have to acknowledge is that the laws have to come somewhere. Now, they can argue about multiverses and other kinds of laws, but that's going way beyond science at this point. The fact is our universe does run on a very lawful situation, and that speaks to me of a God of order, of consistency, Even though we may not always see the consistency, it is there. And that gives me great faith in a deity that can be relied on. I do like a little summary from a recent book by John Walton, The Lost World of Genesis 1, which takes a whole new approach to Genesis, but he wants to make the comment that even though the world is God's place and functions under his control, that doesn't mean that the cosmos is a reflection of God's attributes. So he warns against trying to look for God in the earthquake or he goes on, the cosmos declares God's glory, and his existence can be deduced in the observation of the world. But those truths do not indicate that his attributes are consistently worked out in what we call the natural world. Gravity is not just, rain falls on the righteous and unrighteous alike, and etc. But there is a God behind there. There is a God of order, a God of law, and that to me is a very powerful insight. And Mormonism long taught that, even though it's kind of fallen into disuse in recent years.
Very cool, very cool. George, do you want to offer a closing thought along those lines?
Sure. Dwayne, I actually have that book on my nightstand. I just bought it last week, so I'm looking forward to reading it. I would say that as I understand the story of the war in heaven and the pre-mortal existence, God is somebody who is willing to take a gamble on human agency, that he and I think also on natural process, which I think shows that he is a God of incredible faith and trust, but also a God who's willing to take the necessary, I guess, moral risk. I say necessary because I think it's necessary for our moral development that allowed us to have this mortal experience. But in terms of the specific qualities of the natural world as I understand them, he seems to be a God who places tremendous value on diversity, and even sees beauty in diversity and in strangeness. I love Annie Dillard's way of thinking about these things.
With the giraffe.
Everyone has those sort of planet Earth moments when you're watching those great documentaries and you're looking at something really bizarre. And I think there's such beauty in bizarreness. Steve Peck at BYU, I heard him give a lecture on ants, and I had never thought of ants as beautiful until I heard him speak about that. And I think it's a challenge for me to rise to the occasion to try to see beauty in unexpected ways and places, and to appreciate and protect beauty and diversity wherever I find it, because I think anything that is out there in the way the world works is something that is part of what God is making use of to give us this opportunity to be alive.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
So I think what just to maybe finish a quick thought that I heard Joanna articulating is that idea of spirit and nature and animation of the physical world. I just think that Mormonism places such holiness and centrality on the earth and the earthly experience and the body. I think we are extraordinarily interested in embodiment in our theology, and I think the life of the body and the life of the earth are inherently holy, and to be enjoyed as such.
Thank you, both of you, and to Joanna, who's dropped off. I can't think of a better way to close than with that particular, those couple of expressions there. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in again. This has been a longer one than our typical thing. I don't know that we'll naturally go 2.5-3 hours the way that we're looking like we've managed here, but we hope that this has been enjoyable. I felt like it was a beautiful, full discussion. Millions of more things that we could certainly have said, but I hope that's been helpful to you, and it certainly helped me reinstalling within me some optimism thanks to the stories and the perspectives that were given. So I appreciate you guys very much. Hope you enjoyed yourselves.
Thank you very much, Dan. It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Dwayne, and thank you, Joanna.
Thanks to all. It's been a very delightful experience. Good
Great.
Night.
good night. And listeners, if you'll go to the website at mormonmatters.org, we'll certainly have a blog discussion about the different issues raised here. And I invite Dwayne and George and Joanna to follow that discussion. I'll alert them when it begins. And perhaps if there are things that weren't said or perspectives that you want to share, we certainly will welcome them at the blog. And while you're at the blog, you can certainly click on the donate button and become a subscriber to Mormon Matters Podcast, a tax-deductible donation that will go through the Open Stories Foundation that's set up to build a community to further the work of discussions like this, where nobody's afraid to say what they think and nobody's afraid of critique, as well as to always remind ourselves of the richer and the more robust and vital things that are also in this tradition that has formed us all so much. So we're grateful, and thank you guys, and good night.
Good night.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well. All is well. All is well.